Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Continuing with the chapter, the second exit point from the cycle. And we've just been talking about the difficulties that come from crossing that bridge between feeling and craving, Vedana and Tanha. This principle goes against a lot of our current cultural conditioning. In the West, we put a lot of effort and money and energy into getting lost in what we like and what we love and what we hate. We pay good money to get carried away by that train. I'm speaking from my own experience. There can be a certain thrill and excitement that comes from being carried away from that type of absorption. Biting the apple. But some of us are tired of experiencing the bit that comes after, the sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. But please do come into the, yes, there's cushions and mats, yeah, don't be afraid. In terms of working with the mind, the most common teaching of the forest Ajahns is the aiming of attention at the connection between feeling and craving, Vedana and Tanha. This was a common teaching for Ajahn Sao, Ajahn Man, and Ajahn Chah, and it was a common teaching in classical times as well. This connection between feeling and craving is described as the weakest link of the cycle. This is where we can have the most effect with the least complications and painful side effects. It's also notable that within the Buddha's explanation of what, or how he laid out the Four Noble Truths and the cause of dukkha, he names as tanha, as craving. He doesn't call it ignorant, didn't say ignorance or anything else. He specifically names tanha as the origin or the cause of dukkha, because that I would say is that's the sort of the key point, the crucial point where the mind really gets lost. And so when the mind is drawn into craving, then it's very, very likely that dukkha is going to be a result of that. So there, in the teaching of dependent origination, the cycle starts at avijja, at ignorance. But I feel it's significant that in the description of the Four Noble Truths, which is the sort of pocket version of dependent origination, that the Buddha highlights tanha, craving, as the source, as the cause of dukkha, because it's much more tangible, visible, and apparent than avijja, sort of just not seeing clearly or not being completely mindful, not being aware. That's far more difficult to discern, or is a bit more vague and unclear, whereas craving, tanha, has got a lot more in the way of sharp edges. The emphasis is on learning how to be restrained with respect to pleasant feelings, how to be patient with painful, uncomfortable feelings, and alert to neutral feelings. This kind of learning to work with the realm of feeling is the centerpiece of our forest tradition training. On a practical level, this is carried out through learning how to find contentment with having very few possessions or desire objects. That said, we don't aim to torture ourselves, but the forest monastic life is a very direct training, aiming right at our attachments and habits, our preferences. Most of us don't realize the degree to which the mind is addicted to chasing things that are pleasant and resisting things that are painful. If we become aware of the degree of addiction and learn how to not get lost in feeling, at that moment where feeling changes to craving, we free the heart in a very radical way. And a few sessions ago, I was talking about this being the basis of the forest sort of tradition practice and Dutanga practices. So the form of our life and our way of training, of keeping things very honest, very simple, having few possessions and few desire objects, so that keeping the standard of celibacy, not seeking entertainments, being honest, non-violent, having a fewness of needs, living communally, sharing the resources that we have. All of these are sort of principles that are trying to establish a standard of simplicity and a kind of diminishing the personal emotional entanglement that can so easily be a large part of human life. And so that learning how to work with pleasant feelings, so that the pleasant feelings that we have, they're not things that we're going to chase, that we're going to create a lot of karma around, other than maybe eating too much one day, or filling our mind with too much Buddhist literature or non-Buddhist literature. But when the sensory indulgence, if you're keeping within the bounds of the standards and conduct, you can't really go too far into negativity, into sort of the negative results. Similarly with negative feelings, we're not engaging in physical violence or not engaging in following up feelings of contention or aggression towards other people, so that uncomfortable feelings or negative feelings, negative impressions of other people, we're not acting on them. We might feel them, might spill out into the world, into the realm of speech, but we're not sort of poisoning each other. There's nobody sort of sneaking poisons into the porridge to do away with, you know, that monk who's really annoying. But we refrain from murder and such like. The aim of our lives and the way of life is simplicity, keeping things very benign, and so that we can watch the patterns of liking, disliking, and neutral feelings, that they can be known without the mind getting sort of drawn into emotionally intense and karmically loaded choices like acting violently towards other people, acting dishonestly towards other people, engaging sexually with other people, and so on and so forth. And then, as I was mentioning the other day, the Dutanga practices, the forest tradition life, we make use of the Dutangas, these are particular ways of raising the stakes, as it were, if you can use a gambling analogy, to challenge those habits of attachment a bit more acutely. And so things like limiting the amount of food you have, or how many times, eating strictly one meal a day, limiting your things in terms of your living space, having very few possessions or very few furnishings, with sleep, just sleeping so many hours a day, or not lying down to sleep and such like. So that again, I realize most people are lay people here, but we're all living in a monastery out of the forest tradition. So it's helpful to understand that these Dutanga practices, they're not a form of self-torture. They were all specifically allowed and described and allowed by the Lord Buddha, that they're ways of challenging those very basic attachments we have, as I was saying the other day, to sleep, comfort, food, and personal space. That's generally what they're so all they're all sort of geared towards those very basic instincts, what I would call the reptile brain territory of the mind. And so that and I've often said when I was a novice, I undertook the practice of just living on the food that was given on the almsround through the village. It was amazing. You could see what was on the plate of a villager about 50 yards away, and you're sort of fourth or fifth in line. And you can see past all the other novices and monks, all the way to the villagers kneeling down on the village street, like 50 yards away, and you count the bananas. Damn, there's only four. I'm number six on the line, so I'm not going to get a banana. So, Really, I mean, it's kind of amazing how sharp your vision could get when it's like, food, want food, you know. And with a 21-year-old's body with a fully active desire system, the only thing you can, the only desire objects you can latch onto is food. Then it's amazing how clear a plate can be at 50 yards. So those are the kind of you don't do it to torture yourself or make life difficult, but it's to get to know those instinctual attachments. You know, food, sleep, comfort, personal space, and such like, so that there's a skillful and deliberate challenging of those instinctual reactions, not because discomfort is intrinsically liberating, but because the very act of having chosen to create that limitation, you know, you've asked for it, you've deliberately taken that on, so it gives it a different context. And so then it's an opportunity to look at that, wanting to get comfortable, or wanting to not be so hot, or not too cold, or wanting to not feel hunger, or see how the mind relates to food, and so on and so forth. It was interesting to me because living in northeast Thailand in the late 70s, it was the food was very, very poor generally. It was. What Pananachart was very well supported, but still, it was a kind of protein and vitamin free diet. I would say, with all great respect to the villagers of Bung Wai and Warin locally, but the food was generally pretty poor, and I was so skinny when you know there were not that many white monks coming off the plane, but when my mother and my sisters were there at the airport to meet me, also a couple of the monks from Chithurst. And my sisters didn't recognize me. There were not a crowd of white. I mean, I was the only one white monk. I mean, I did have a lot of hair when I left, but I had no hair when I came back. My mother recognized me, but my sisters didn't recognize me. So anyway, when I came back to England, it was because my father had a heart attack, and then a couple of days after I'd arrived. And you know, my mother met me at the airport. Then when my dad was off the critical list, then my mother collapsed. So she was in one hospital, and my father was in another hospital. And so I stayed with the family, with my sisters, shuttling back and forth between different hospitals for about 3 or 4 weeks. Then my mother came out of the hospital, she recovered. And so during that time, I was being abundantly fed with... the English diet of sort of feed the boy, you know, he's hungry, and I put on about what would it be? It was about a stone, in less than a month I put on probably about 6 kilos, 7 kilos in a month, and so and it was what was really interesting in terms of meditation was whereas in Thailand. A lot of my mind, my fantasy life would go towards food and expectation of food. Once my body was sort of nourished and there was lots of food around, then it was amazing how I could sit for a whole hour and the idea of food didn't cross my mind. It's like, oh, that changed. And just seeing how that the conditions as they were produced those particular mind states of, food is good, where is food, I want food. And then when the body had a bit more nourishment in it, then that was completely gone. So something that had been such like a strong or repetitive presence, saying, that was totally dependent on conditions. And when the conditions change, then those mind states don't have any basis, they don't arise. So these Dutanga practices are about getting to know how convincing those urges towards comfort or personal space or food and sleep and so forth, how convincing, how powerful they can be, like as they're not sort of non-verbal, non-conceptual forces that we feel. They're very much reptile brain and non-conceptual forces in the mind. But we can recognize, this is, even though this is, it declares itself as something real, important and solid, it is just a mind state. and then the attention that doesn't have to be absorbed in that, doesn't have to be carried away by that. And so the purpose of those, the simplicity of our life, and particularly the Dutanga practices, is to help develop that skill to get to know the realm of feeling, liking, disliking, and so forth, without confusion, just to know that, oh, this is feeling, and to help them to train the mind not to cross that bridge between feeling and craving. So it's like developing those spiritual muscles, if you like, those spiritual strength to know just because you're hungry, it's not the end of the world, just because you've eaten too much and then you're full, then it's also not the end of the world. But the mind is getting to know that realm of feeling directly, and is learning how not to be confused or to be entrapped in that. So any thoughts, questions? Okay. One other example that comes to mind, actually talking about this, many of us don't realize the degree to which the mind is addicted to things. Interesting experience when I went to a conference with His Holiness the Dalai Lama in McLeod Ganj Dharamsala in India, and it was March, and it was a conference for a number of Western Buddhist teachers to meet together with the Dalai Lama. And we were all staying in this particular hotel in McLeod Ganj, which is a little town up on the hill where the Dalai Lama's monastery and sort of home village is. And there were power cuts. Power was out in McLeod Ganj. And so there was about 25 or 30 of us as Western Dhamma teachers. And so one of the people in the group, It was March. It was about this kind of temperature, sort of cold, damp, you know, not quite freezing, but definitely damp and dank. A wonderful word in the north of England, drich. It's a Northumbrian word. Drich is a kind of cold, damp, grey, drich kind of weather. So anyway, this particular Dhamma teacher asked the hotel manager, my clothes are quite damp from the from our travels. Can I use a drying machine? Terribly sorry, madam. There's no power. We don't have a dryer. She said, no, but I've got to dry my clothes. We have no means of creating heat for you, madam. This is the temperature it is. You'll just have to hang your clothes up and wait for them to dry. She said, it's cold and damp. They're not going to get dry. And I'm sorry. And it was, I'm not trying to make fun of her or belittle her, but it was really interesting how she became really distressed. And she'd never come across having a sort of comfortable Western middle-class life. She'd never come across a situation where she couldn't just have dry clothes or that they could get warmth in a room. It was just, she'd never experienced that. And it's like, but you don't understand. I've got my everything's damp. And this poor fellow was like, sorry, madam, nothing to be done. But it was really interesting. Someone who's a very gifted Dhamma teacher and very highly respected. In that moment, there was like that revelation of how there was an expectation of, I can always have dry clothes, or I can find a place of comfort. And not knowing what to do, not knowing how to handle that sense of no, it's cold and damp, and here it is, it's like this, and at that time, not having a refuge for that. A counterpart to that is when I was on Tudong with Lumpur Sumetho in the northwest of England in 1987. We went on a Tudong through Lancashire and through the forest of Bowland and into the Lake District. And the day we set off, it was brilliant sunshine, walking along a canal, it was nice and level, beautiful flowers blooming, like wild yellow irises. Oh, well, this is a nice Tudong. So then that was day one. And then we walked up this steep hill into the hills, and it was like horizontal rain for the next 4 or 5 days. It was absolutely pouring down, everything was soaked. And Nick Scott was leading us through this, And so day after day, just pouring with rain. And after 3 or 4 days of walking through this landscape, we got to Morecambe Bay. And we're camping by Morecambe Bay, near to the Manjushri Institute. And so we kind of unpacked and got the tents up, and I was sharing a tent with Lumpur, and everything was wet. There was one dry sock between the three of us. Everything else was wet. Well, our clothes were wet, the tents were wet, the sleeping bags were wet. Everything was wet. And it was that same kind of dreich, soggy weather. And Lumpur, he's often mentioned it in Dhamma talks, he said, climbing into a wet sleeping bag when you're exhausted on a cold, you know, on a cold night, he said, actually, it's quite all right. So this is, if you asked me, it would be a horrible thing to do. But actually, climbing into a wet sleeping bag in a dripping tent on a rainy night in the north of England, and it's actually okay. And that was quite a realization, that there's something that's so off-putting in theory, but actually in it, if the mind doesn't make a problem out of it, it's just this. And then we did have big tumble dryers at Manjushri, able to dry everything the next day. But it was an insightful moment, just where everything is wet. And it's when you've got a few things that are still dry, you're trying to hang on to them. But then when everything is wet and there's absolutely no alternative, then something just says, okay, yeah, here we are. But my good friend in Dharamsala, she didn't have that access to evenness of mind, but that's one of the causes for us to be living simply and having a few possessions and making Suzuki Roshi put it, that the Buddhist practice is changing from finding happiness through getting what you like to liking what you get. It's a very simple nugget. Okay, to continue. With respect to dependent origination, Ajahn Chah pointed out, as mentioned earlier, that this process happens very fast. It's like falling from a tree and trying to count the branches on the way down. Generally, all you know is that when you hit the ground, it hurts. In terms of neurophysiology, pasa, sense contact, is the electrical impulse going from the sense organ through the nerves to the brain. In the case of vision, light is registered, captured by the eye, an impulse travels through the optic nerve to the brain and triggers the region of the brain that relates to vision. This is pasa, the electrical sense contact. Vedana, so it's a sayatana pasa vedana, six senses contact feeling. Vedana is probably best translated as sensation rather than feeling, because the word feeling tends to carry the sense of emotion. Vedana is almost always defined as simply pleasant, painful, or neutral sensation. And so Anagarika Margit's not here today. Anyway, she brought up the other day that there are broader definitions or other places where it does refer more to qualities of emotional tone. So it's what I've written here in the book is it's a kind of rough description. But the other aspects of what's called pleasant mental feeling is somanasa. So when we do the funeral chanting, we go through the vipassana bhumi, the basis of insight. So that somanas indriyang, domanas indriyang, upek indriyang. So somanasa is pleasant mental feeling. So it's a kind of vedana, but it's a specifically mental feeling. And domanasa is unpleasant mental feeling. And so a number of mind states or things that we deal with in terms of Western psychology, in terms of depression and self-hatred, self-criticism, depressive mental states and such like, then domanasa would refer to a certain amount of that, as a certain overlap between domanasa and the Western psychological ideas or principles of depression. And there's a particular Buddhist group I think their website is kind of domanasa.org or .uk, is And it's using Buddhist meditation to work with depression, using particularly mindfulness-based cognitive therapy for depression. And so that I haven't looked it up, but recently, but yeah. So they use the term Dhammanasa as a, sort of the name for that that group or that collection of teachings and materials that they make available. So, Vedana, it is not complicated. We inherit this from our most remote ancestors, little monocellular plankton of billions of years ago. Even an entity as simple as that can perceive, does it hurt? Does it not hurt? Is it pleasant? Can I ignore it? Can I consume it? Will it consume me? Vedana is generally a very basic experience. So that it's so the most so rudimentary forms of life in little zooplankton or monocellular entities that they know, you know, what is edible, what's what they can consume in terms of food that's nourishing, they can move towards it. What's dangerous, and they can move away from it. Or what's a predator that's going to attack them, then they can recognize the signs of a predator and move away. So these instincts of pleasant, painful, and you know, and to be ignored, they are they're very, very fundamental. They're kind of very ancient, deeply rooted instinctual impulses in us. So they're not easy to ignore or overlook. They have very, and so it's important to recognize that the power or the strength that those that the realm of Vedana has. These are, you know, very ancient, deeply rooted instincts. So that, and I think this is one of the reasons why the Buddha points to tanha as the cause of dukkha. It's like recognizing that the habitual reactions to Vedana, pleasant feeling, painful feeling, neutral feeling, are so strong, so deeply rooted, it's very easy to cross that bridge to, I like to, I want, I've got to have, or I don't like, or this is dangerous, get away, or I hate. That those are very powerful forces in the mind, but by pointing directly to tanha, say, pay attention to this spot, Vedana Pachaya Tanha, and then that can make all the difference in the world if that realm of feeling is genuinely understood, and there's we develop a kind of robustness or strength in relationship to liking, disliking, and neutral feeling. Then that goes a long way to supporting our spiritual efforts. And again, it's one of the main reasons of the mode of practice and the way of life that we have in the forest tradition. The question can arise, what is it that knows Vedana? The simplest answer is that it is the awareness of the mind. Awareness is the medium of knowing. It's the means whereby anything and everything is known. On this point, I would suggest to keep it simple, rather than to try to conceptualize the nature of that awareness. All that needs to be known is, here is pleasant feeling, painful feeling, neutral feeling. This means being aware rather than thinking about awareness. In this way, the habit of crossing the bridge can be observed and understood. We can learn how the mind shifts from experiencing a pleasant feeling to, oh, I want to have that. Yes.
Can I ask a question? Pleasant feeling is something that is promising, right? So, if, for example, you see something, okay, I can consume it, it's promising that it will give some nourishment. It means that emotional tone is pleasant, mm-hmm. and you are encouraged by the body to do it. And if it's some kind of thought, like mental impression, and like somebody said to you something, and it means like something good for you in social terms or in terms of future, mm-hmm. and has a positive tone to it, so it's also promising. Mm-hmm. But it's still not tanha yet, right? So if in terms of idea or thought, and you have a pleasant feeling, some joy arises, it means that it's something like your mind calculated that it's something good for you for mm-hmm. the future. But after it, like, you can recognize that what it's doing, it's still not to cross the bridge to the tongue.
Yeah, if it's the point where you believe in the promise, mm-hmm. It's like looking at an advert, an advertisement in a magazine or a newspaper or on a, you know, some kind of say thing that is presented. It's promising you if you go on this holiday you'll be happy, or if you have this watch then it'll be reliable and be giving you all kinds of wonderful possibilities and such like. So you can know that there's a promise there. Or the other side with a threat, you know, and the negative. You can know that it's going with like advertisements. You know, there's a promise, but you don't. There doesn't have to be the belief in that. That you can recognize, oh, this is making its presentation of its promising happiness if you have this car or this holiday or this watch or whatever. But so the mind can recognize, oh, there's a promise there, but it doesn't have to believe it. Doesn't have to buy into that. So I would say exactly, you're exactly right. It's the knowing this is likable, this is pleasant, this is attractive, but so what? Yeah, there isn't the compulsion to pick it up. So where it becomes tanha is ooh, the mind is born into that and say it believes in the promise or it believes in the threat or. And so it's buying into the content of it. If there's an awareness, oh, this is a promise, or this is something that's is being presented in an attractive in a way to attract the attention. Okay, it's just that much. The mind isn't adding anything onto it. It's just knowing it as it is. Like so, the word asada, gratification, and then its partner adinava. The downside or the shadow, the liability. So it's very helpful to get to know that. And I mentioned it a few times how the Buddha is acknowledging that yes, there is gratification when there is something that's pleasant, like a pleasant taste or a sound or a visual object or like say a promise of this looks good or this tastes delicious. That gratification, that asada is there, but the problems come when the mind then buys into that and thinks, oh, this is going to make me happy in a substantial way, or I can keep this, or this makes me a good person or an impressive person or a powerful person, an attractive person, that kind of thing. And so that it's knowing that it's not a matter of pretending or suppressing that gratification, or like to not see or feel, taste anything, to kind of neutralize the senses. It's not a matter of wiping out sense activity. And I feel like that's very helpful in the Buddha's teaching. Like, yes, there is the gratification, but its partner is the adinava, the liability. That, yes, there is that, it's gratifying, but there's its partner in that. It can only be exciting or satisfying to a certain degree, or it can't make you permanently happy, or it can't bring all of the effects that you think it might do, and if you invest hope and commitment in that object, whatever it might be, again, not just watches and cars, but also Dhamma teachers or the monasteries or, you know, that is the thing that's going to make all the difference, and the mind buys into that gratification, then the liability, the degree to which you've invested in that, then you also invest in the heartbreak that comes when it lets you down. You know, the monastery is not the, it's not the, such a welcoming place, or the watch breaks down, or your car gets scratched, like in that example, that they go together, the asada and adinava. But if that's known, that oh, this is just this is gratification. Yes, there's this liking. Yes, you're not pretending that you don't like it. That there isn't that liking, but the mind isn't confused about that or not expecting too much of it. It's just the gratifying experience. Yes, this is the yes experience. That's all. So then it's known and fully accepted. But there isn't any limitation that comes from that. Yes?
Ajahn, I'd like to ask about dealing with emotions. Mm-hmm.
emotions, but if emotions are negative ones, like anger and like deeply stored layers of hate that can arise from time to time,
mm-hmm.
Through this process of purifying and allowing things to be raised to consciousness, to awareness, in order to just to release and to purify oneself. And when I look sometimes at those moments where the anger or hate can arise, even though there is the experience that's impersonal because that's not who I am, but sometimes when the awareness is not swift enough, the discernment is not swift enough, that energy can seep through and take form of thought.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And then one is somehow responsible already for the violence that the thought carries as the energy. So my question would be, is that the karmic already creating a karmic response, even the thinking or thought, which I understand is not me?
There's different ways of relating to it. It's important to recognize sila, or virtue, only relates to action and speech in that respect, in the strict definition of it. And so if there is a skillful attitude, you know, if there are like violent or angry thoughts and feelings arise, if they've already sort of come into being, if the practice is developed, then there can be a recognition of knowing those feelings, knowing those emotions and those waves, and not suppressing them, but not identifying with them as me and mine, but knowing them as they are. So if you've read or listened to many of Lumpur Sumedho's Dhamma talks, he experienced a lot of anger when he was a young monk and a novice, and he always thought of himself as a very sort of friendly, loving, liberal, easygoing kind of a person. And he didn't realize how much he just sort of had suppressed his angry impulses. So when he was spending that first year in the Kuti in Nongkhai, when he was a novice, he was astonished at the waves of rage that would come up in relationship, particularly to his family, his parents and so on. And so this. I'm a nice person. I would never do that. You know, but kind of surprised at the intensity of it, but it was really just, in a sense, letting go or acknowledging things that have been suppressed or hidden away. If it's understood and known for what it is, then it's more like it's the resultant karma, it's the vipaka of habits that have been created in the past. It's like, okay, it bears this fruit. But if it's not acted on, or if it's not suppressed or identified with, or this is, I've got an anger problem, I've got to do something with this, so I don't have this anger problem, so it's turned into me and mine, then that either suppressing or indulging or even that kind of identifying with that, that's all going to be feeding it or kind of making it stronger, creating new karma around it. But if it's just known for what it is, then it's just the sort of resonance of, or the results of past actions, past habits. And so there's nothing negative about it at all. Like, Lumpur Cha was famous for his having a short temper, and that he had to work with a lot. And in the book, The Island, I put together with Ajahn Pasno, recounted this incident where a palm reader came to Wat Bapong, and Ajahn Chah was very anti superstition and astrology and fortune telling of every kind. And this guy who came to visit, he knew, and he was a professional astrologer, and he thought he was going to keep quiet about his livelihood. But he found himself trying to look to see Ajahn Chah's hands as he was sitting and talking and kind of making gestures, and so. He, after being with Lumpur Cha for quite some time, he couldn't resist. I know he's going to give me a bad time because he's really down on fortune tellers, but he couldn't resist. So at the end, he asked Lumpur, Lumpur, I realize, you don't approve of astrology and fortune telling and such like, but I'm a palm reader, I'm a sort of psychic astrologer type. Modu is, it literally translates as a doctor of seeing. So that's an astrologer or a fortune teller. It's a very broad category. Anyway, so Lumpur Chai gave him a bit of a bad time. Eventually said, okay, take a look. Tell me, am I gonna win the lottery? Kind of thing. So anyway, the fellow looked at his hands and said, and he was quite startled, and he said, Lumpur, this line here says, you've got a lot of anger. And Lumpur said, yes, but I don't use it. So that he was aware of that habit, and it had been a big feature of his life. I could be really impatient and intolerant of people and things, but he'd worked with it a lot, so that that didn't have a place to land. And that his comment was, yes, but I don't use it. So that, and then when Lumpur Dun similarly was asked by a disciple when he was in his 90s, Lumpur, do you still have anger? And he said, ni demai ao, which is like, it's, yes, it's there, but I don't accept it or I don't receive it. Like something comes in the post and it's come to the wrong address. You say, oh, no, there's, you brought the parcel to the wrong address. It's a return to sender. It's not for this address. You have to take the parcel away. So it's not received or not accepted. Okay, so the next section is called Experiencing Pain and Discomfort. So this, again, this is going into a bit more detail about a particular aspect of meditation. When sitting in meditation for long periods of time, it's very natural to have pain in our legs, back, and different parts of the body. When pain arises in the body, this is an ideal opportunity to look at the process of feeling, and while looking at it and feeling it, learn how not to add anything to it. We feel pain. We feel dislike for that sensation, but we can train the mind to simply know that as it is. We can train the mind not to create suffering out of that painful feeling. This is described in the teachings in a sutta called simply the arrow. An arrow is from a bow and arrow, people understand that? The Buddha used the image of a soldier being shot on the battlefield, and people often forget that, or don't realize that, the Buddha was a soldier for a long time. He's a long military background from when he was a teenager to when he was 29. He was a warrior noble, so he has a lot of military analogies in his teachings, in his language. It's often not acknowledged, but they have a lot of military language and examples. So this is one of them. So the image is one of a soldier being shot with an arrow on the battlefield. The first arrow that hits the soldier represents the feeling of physical pain. If you have a body and mind, this first arrow is inescapable. The second arrow that is fired at the soldier is everything the mind adds to that, fearing the pain, resenting it, negotiating with it, waiting for it to be over. All of that fretting, worrying, stressing around the feeling of pain, that is the second arrow. The Buddha said that the second arrow can be avoided if we are aware, if we are mindful. And it's quite a short sutta. If you want to look it up, it's in the Connected Discourses. I think it's in the Salayatana, the Connected Discourses about the Six Senses. Sutta number 6, called the arrow, Salla, the Salla Sutta. In the teaching of the Four Noble Truths, the Buddha talks about the complete ending of suffering. That ending of suffering, quote-unquote, is not about never experiencing physical pain. Rather, it is all about the second arrow, what the mind adds onto things. So, again, I've mentioned that a few times, but talking about dukkha nirodha, it's not never having any physical pain, not having any, or any, even any mental pain, like the dominasa somanasa. But it's all about the second arrow, what the mind adds to those natural painful feelings. Even if you are a fully enlightened Buddha, nobody can evade the first arrow of physical pain. When he was an old man, the Buddha had chronic back pain. He felt physical pain all the time. He said that only if he absorbed his mind into complete emptiness would he not be aware of painful feeling in the body. So the image he used, he said, my body's like an old cart held together with strings and straps. And so the only way I can experience comfort is to completely absorb the mind into emptiness. If he was aware of the body, he was aware of painful feeling. And that's the beginning of the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, the discourse about the Buddha's last days. So Digha Nikaya, long discourses, Sutta number 16. Although the Buddha experienced physical pain, he knew how not to suffer from it. So when we sit in meditation for long periods of time, that's a good opportunity to learn how to avoid the second arrow. We can experience physical pain, but the heart can be completely at peace with it. With the right attitude, pain might be present, but it is known as absolutely not a problem. So also sometimes people think, well, you know, the Buddha had such good meditation, he didn't feel the physical pain, but it's not an insignificant comment. He said, only if he completely absorbs his mind into emptiness, and I think in that context it means withdrawing his attention from all sense activity, then he would feel comfort. He would be free of pain. If he was paying attention to the sensory field, then there would be pain mixed in with that. And so, and I think I mentioned the other day how it's not uncommon where he says he's giving a Dhamma talk leaning against the pillar in the middle of the Dhamma hall. Or he says to Venerable Sariputta, Sariputta, my back is paining me. The assembly is still awake. I'm going to go and rest my back. You know, please carry on giving a teaching. Or there's another very poignant moment where the Buddha is sitting on the veranda, the porch of his kuti, and the sun is setting, and he's warming his back in the rays of the setting sun, like a heat lamp, sort of easing his back, using the heat of the sun to ease the aches in his back. And then Venerable Ananda comes along, and there's a little dialogue between them, and Ananda says, it's amazing, it's incredible, you used to be, the body of the Tathagata used to be sort of young and muscular and vigorous, and now it's all kind of saggy and old and wrinkled. And the Buddha says, yes, indeed, Ananda. The body indeed is all wrinkled and saggy and old. Yeah. Youth has gone. The advice Ajahn Chah would give about physical pain in meditation was to make the effort to work with it. If we move our body as soon as we feel discomfort, we never learn how to get beyond suffering. It's a bit of a sweeping statement, but I realize on my part, but that's one of the chief ways that we learn to get beyond suffering, to evade that second arrow, is to develop a quality of endurance, or to not just shying away from physical pain, and as soon as we feel discomfort, to change the posture and to get to get rid of the painful feeling as fast as we can, but to develop something of a quality of patience. So, if we move our body as soon as we feel discomfort, we never learn how to get beyond suffering. We never learn how to avoid that second arrow. If we're trying to pay attention to our breath and we start to experience pain in the knee or the thigh or the back, we may think, ah, if only that pain wasn't there, I could concentrate properly. It really hurts. I wish it would go away. I'm not reading anybody's mind. It's just very familiar, I think, for probably all of us, that this is the way the mind works. We unconsciously create resistance, negativity, aversion, fear around the painful feeling. When we notice that the mind is reacting to the pain in that way, the most helpful response is to turn the attention to where the painful feeling is. Don't think of it as an unwanted intruder, but instead make it the center of attention. In other words, invite it, welcome it in. When we bring attention to physical pain, we notice that there are two aspects to it. A physical aspect and a mental aspect. On the physical side, there is usually resistance. The body tenses up against it. The muscles become tight and rigid in the area of that pain. So, firstly, we place the attention on that area and consciously invite those muscles to relax. Let those muscles be free of tension, free of stress and tightness. When working with the tension that comes from the mental aspect, consciously bring to mind the quality of patience, thinking, it's a painful feeling, but it can be tolerated for another couple of minutes. No permanent physical damage will happen within the next little while. Let's see if I can be fully patient, fully accepting of the sensation. Here it is, right now. It's just a painful feeling. Bring these kinds of thoughts to mind. Be accepting. Acknowledge this painful feeling as part of the natural physical process. In this manner, we relax the body and we relax the attitude. When we work with physical pain in this way, we're increasing the quality of mindfulness and awareness so that in this moment, there's a more complete attunement, more complete harmony with the body's limits. If we're patient with that painful feeling, if we open the heart to it and bring forth the quality of acceptance, so like aspect of metta or radical acceptance and kindness, then after a few minutes, it's easier to recognize when it is right to move. Okay, now it's enough. It's time. The body is now under strain, so this is the time to move it. In this way, the choice to change the posture is based on kindness towards the body rather than upon aversion to pain. Oh, a couple of things to say about that. So when, if you notice, oftentimes we think, well, I'm concentrating on the breath. That's my practice, and this pain is getting in the way. So Lumpo Chao would give the standard advice of, you know, if you are distracted by a painful feeling, you try to bring your attention back to the breath, but your mind keeps getting pulled back. After the third time that it's pulled back to the painful feeling, just make the pain the object and sort of put the breath aside for the time being and use the painful feeling as the meditation object. And then with this, even though we tend to tense up against a pain and resist it, that very stressing, that tensing up of the muscles, increases the causes of the pain. It brings more stress into the system. So even though there's a kind of relief, sort of like a scratching an itch, that tensing up against it, the actual tensing, it creates more causes for pain. So it's a bit counterintuitive when you bring attention to a painful feeling, say in the knee, then to consciously relax the muscles in that area, then you're reducing the causes of the pain. So it's against that impulse to just tense up and resist it. But if you do, then you're diminishing the causes for the painful feeling. The more the body is relaxed, then generally speaking, the less pain there is. And this other principle I'm talking about here in the last part, what I was reading is very, very important, because if we change posture based on fear of pain, what kind of damage is going to happen to my body, impatience, trying to get an aversion, so fear and aversion, if that's the cause, then even though when we change the posture, we might have a moment of relief and think, oh, thank goodness, then we're also creating the conditions for more aversion and more fear. And so as soon as there's another little, kind of another twinge, then, oh no, it's come back again. Oh no, oh no, oh, I thought I got rid of that. Oh no, it's the other knee. Oh. And so that having acted on aversive and fearful, initiative, that being what informs the choice of changing the posture, then that's the cause, and so the effect matches that. So as I was saying earlier, that cause and effect are unified. So if you have a cause that's based on fear and aversion, then it's going to have a tense and aversive, anxious result. So in terms of genuinely working with pain in a skillful way, then to attune to the body, to know the body, to feel the sensation that's there, to really attune the attention to that feeling, then you also bring into action the intuitive sense of the body's limits. So even though it's not a calculation, There's just a, and you're using your own intuitive sense, the body's intelligence in a way, of knowing, okay, this joint is now being stretched, it's being strained beyond a certain limit, that this is enough. And so then, out of kindness for the body, knowing, okay, now it's reached its limit, this is definitely being stretched to a point of being overstretched, so now it's time to change the body, change the posture. And so then it's a motivation is one of kindness and the wise recognition of the body's limits. So because the choice is made based on wholesome and skillful attitudes, then the result of changing the posture then has a much more peaceful and harmonious and well-integrated result. So that's what I found over many, many years of meditating, working with painful feelings, that it genuinely, at least in my experience, this is the way that it works. And so it's very helpful to be, and also you need to be as honest as possible, because the inner lawyer, the inner legal committee can say, well, yeah, I'm only changing the posture out of kindness. This is strictly just kindness only. Phew, now I can get away from that nasty pain. So it's kind of presents itself as kindness, but the actuality is like, I hate this, I'm afraid of it, and I want it to go away. So you have to be aware of the legal weaseling, not to be abusive towards weasels, but that's sort of sneaky. I've got a very sneaky habits of mind, so I'm familiar with weaseling and the sneakiness, the way that the inner legal team can make a very good case of this is actually genuinely kindness and wholesome. But to be as honest and sincere as possible is important. If we move too quickly, that's not helpful, because we never learn to deal with the second arrow. But if we don't move at all, that could mean a trip to the osteopath or the hospital. And there's a long list of monastics that overzealous monastics who sit got very extravagant with their yoga postures. One monk here actually wrecked his knee, demonstrating how not to put the legs into a lotus posture. Whatever you do, don't do it like this. And then in that action, then it's like, oh, I think I just. And he had to go. He had to go to the doctor. So that was embarrassing. So there's a long, long list of people being overzealous and also coming from the sense of idealism. And I'm going to do this. I'm going to make my. I'm going to get into full lotus and sit there for 3 hours. So it's important to not lead with the head, but to develop the practice with mindfulness and wisdom. So if we don't move at all, it could mean a trip to the osteopath or to the hospital. The middle way, capital M, capital W, is based on the attunement of the heart to the reality of the way things are. Part of this reality is the body, so that attunement to it is what guides our actions. When we develop this attitude of acceptance of painful feeling, it doesn't mean that we become numb or foolish. It doesn't mean that we take no action. Rather, there is a quality of wise attunement and mindfulness. Then we can make wise choices. Then we can make decisions based on the reality of the way things are, rather than on emotional reactivity, hatred, or desire. We don't deliberately create pain in order to make trouble for ourselves, but when it arises, we can work with it in this way and discover whether these principles are valid or not. It's important for everyone to find out for themselves whether things work in this way, or whether they don't. Is this true, or is it not? How do you find it to be? And maybe this the last thing to say on that. So I like to use this phrase, a self-adjusting universe. So even though I use the phrase, we can make wise choices, in essence, it's any sense of I and me and mine is going to add sort of distortion or imbalance to the system. So that the more that the heart is really free of eye-making and mind-making, and there's a genuine attunement to the body and the time, the place, the situation, then We can trust that quality of awareness to be what guides the change of posture. And so rather than the choice, like me making choices to do what to do with my posture, rather letting that the me and mine out of the picture altogether and then trusting in awareness, then you find that the posture will adjust on its own, or that sense of, okay, now's the time to move, that arises on its own. And it's not really me making a choice, it's an effort, really samavayamo, right effort, or attuned effort, is guided by mindfulness and wisdom rather than me making a choice or me deciding what to do. So there's samavayama, right effort, doesn't have any self-view or any conceit involved in it. And so and I think in the morning reflections in the temple, I was mentioning that a few times, how if we cultivate that quality of awareness and there's a letting go of all kind of eye-making and mind-making, then the system adjusts on its own. It's a self-adjusting universe of which your body and your mind are a part. So, my goodness, 7 o'clock has come around already. Any questions, thoughts, reflections? Silence. Yes, sister.
Well, I didn't understand how Vedana is a promise. Vedana, feeling, is promised.
Well, if it's Sukha Vedana, and so that you promising insofar as if you take if you're hungry and you take a bite of some food that is you experience as pleasant, then you take a mouthful and you go, ooh, this is good, this is a good apple or whatever, and so then that is what I would suggest is meant by promise, that there's a looking forward, recognizing, oh, this is delicious, and there's a promise that the rest of the apple will also have a similar sort of delicious or pleasing experience, or bring an experience with it. So it's just that how the mind holds that pleasant experience and creates a sense of enjoyment and looking forward to continuing that. Say if there's more of the apple still to eat.
The Vedana is just a pleasant feeling, but the mind is the one that is creating more.
Well, I think the question Anagarika Evgenia was asking about, so that feeling of promise, is that is that part of the tanha, the crossing the bridge to tanha, you could read it in different ways. Maybe it's putting a foot onto the bridge, because there's a recognition of more of this would be nice, would be good. So you're recognizing that there's a feeling of attraction or interest, but if there's enough mindfulness, then you know that attraction or that interest, it's only got it's not something that has to be followed. So that there's an attraction, there's liking. No, that's just that. That liking, I would say, is in the realm of feeling. It's like it's Sukha Vedana. The mind can like this. Oh, this is delicious. This is beautiful. I like this. But that liking doesn't have to lead to. There can still be a very clear and spacious appreciation of liking, without the mind being caught up in that. No? Yeah, that's a very important principle, really, that because with letting go of tanha, It's not a matter of never experiencing dislike or like. You know, pain is still painful, and pleasure is still pleasurable. But like the Buddha, you know, referring to his back pain, like that, it's still painful, and that he would say, you know, that my back is paining me. I'm going to go and stretch my, you know, stretch out to rest my back, so that he not only did he feel the pain, he was ready to take action to relieve the pain, but still the mind was not giving rise to tanha. It's like taking, and I feel that's a very, those are very significant teachings, so that he was mindfully taking steps to reduce the pain, but without creating a problem out of it, without from the basis of enlightenment. And so I feel those are really important examples for us. And it's because sometimes we tend to think, oh, an enlightened person, they're completely beyond like and dislike. They don't feel anything, or they're completely indifferent, or the things, those liking it, the pleasant and painful, don't really register. But that's I'd say it's a really incorrect understanding.
I understand. So when you, but that is beyond the peaceful of meditation.
Say that again.
Experience peacefulness.
Yeah.
There is acknowledgement that this is pleasant,
mm-hmm.
but there is no attachment. But when it's regard to food,
same.
But then you have, for example, I don't like meat, and I always avoid meat because I don't like it. And when I eat the meat, there is all this anger coming and an unpleasant feeling. And first it's a feeling, and then it's a reaction to the feeling.
You'd have to tell me. I mean, because it's.
Yeah.
We each have to sort of know our own mind and how the mind works. I couldn't guess.
It's first is the feeling and then the reaction to it. But the feeling is unpleasant, because either to the touch or to the smell or the taste or the seeing of the meat. And then the mind reacts to it. But if I'm mindful, then I see all this process, and I can cut this, all this happening, that attachment to it. But there is no more judging, this is pleasant, this is unpleasant, this is, you know, it's just, oh, that's suffering. But there is no more, like, preference towards this and this and that. And so there is no more promise. It's a promise, if I eat the meat, maybe I will see more suffering, so maybe it's better for me. But, there is no more promise in this pleasant, like fruits or in the meat. So that's why I don't see the promise in the food.
Mm-hmm. I think it depends a little bit on exactly how one is using the word. But also, I see it's getting towards 7:10, so don't want to continue too long, but. Yeah, I think distinguishing between what is using the meditation to distinguish what is the feeling, like the two arrows, the painful feeling, the unpleasant feeling, either physical or mental, and then noticing when the mind starts to add to that, and the more simply the mind receives, the physical pain, or here is the feeling of dislike or disgust, or and that's this is the arisen feeling, and it's like this. Then recognizing that doesn't have to be added to. That doesn't have to be bought into. I say that's the important thing. So it's using the practice to get clear about that, how the second arrow can be avoided. That's the important thing. Okay, let's leave it there for today.
Vandamayang dhamma uvada kataya sadhu karang dadamase sadhu.
Sadhu.